Please be seated.
The hearing is called to order. The registrar, could you tell the court the matter on the cause list this morning?
May it please the court. Trial Chamber 1 of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, composed of Judge Leyte Kama presiding, Judge Leonard Aspergren, and Judge Navenetham Pillay, is in session today, Friday, 4 September 1998, to pronounce sentence in the matter of the prosecutor against John Kambanda, case number ICTR 9723S.
Thank you, Registrar. I would ask the prosecutor to present to introduce himself once again. Honorable President, I have the honor of representing the office of the prosecutor. I'm assisted by Mr. Stuart James, and Mr. Chande Oatman, and as well as Mr. Udo. Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Mr. Prosecutor. Could I ask the defense counsel to also introduce himself?
Oliver Inglis of the Cameroon Bar for the defense.
Thank you, Mr. Inglis. I will now ask the accused to come forward and stand before the court. The chamber this morning will deliver its decision on the sentence to be inflicted on Jean Kambanda after his plea of guilty. In its decision, the chamber started by talking briefly on the trial. Thus, the chamber notes that Jean Kambanda was arrested by the Kenyan authorities on the basis of a formal request submitted to them by the prosecutor on 9 July 1997. On 16 July 1997, Judge Leyte Kama, ruling on the prosecutor's motion of 9 July 1997, ordered the transfer and provisional detention of the suspect Jean Kambanda at a detention facility of the tribunal for a period of 30 days. Pursuant to Rule 40 bis of the rules. The provisional detention of Jean Kambanda was extended twice for 30 days, the first time under the provisions of Rule 40 bis F, and the second time under the provisions of Rule 40 bis G. On 16 October 1997, an indictment against the suspect, Jean Kambanda, prepared by the Office of the Prosecutor, was submitted to Judge Yakov Ostrovsky, who confirmed it, issued a warrant of arrest against the accused, and ordered his continued detention. On 1 May 1998, during his initial appearance before this trial chamber, the accused pleaded guilty to the six counts contained in the indictment, namely genocide, conspiracy to commit genocide, direct and public incitement to commit genocide, complicity in genocide, crimes against humanity, that is murder, punishable under Article 3A of the statute, and crimes against humanity, that is extermination, punishable under Article 3B of the statute. After verifying the validity of his guilty plea, particularly in light of an agreement concluded between the prosecutor on the one hand and the accused and his lawyer on the other hand, an agreement which was signed by all the parties, the chamber entered a plea of guilty against the accused on all the counts in the indictment. As said earlier, the chamber sought to scrupulously verify the validity of the guilty plea entered by Mr. Kabanda. In this connection, the chamber asked him, one, whether his plea of guilty was entered voluntarily, in other words, if he did so freely and knowingly without pressure, threats, or promises. Two, whether he clearly understood the charges against him as well as the consequences of his guilty plea. And lastly, three, whether his guilty plea was unequivocal, in other words, if he was aware that the said plea could not be refuted by any line of defense. The accused replied in the affirmative to all these questions. On the strength of these answers, the chamber delivered its decision from the bench as follows. Mr. Jean Kabanda, having deliberated and after verifying that your plea of guilty is voluntary, unequivocal, and that you clearly understood its terms and consequences, considering the factual and legal issues contained in the agreement concluded between you and the Office of the Prosecutor, and that you have acknowledged that both of you and your counsel have signed, the tribunal finds you guilty on the 6 counts brought against you, orders your continued detention, and rules that a status conference will be held immediately after this hearing with the registrar to set a date for the pre-sentencing hearing. After having made a summary of the procedure in its decision, the chamber considered the law and principles applicable. First of all, with regard to the applicable text, the chamber invoked Article 22 of the statute relating to the judgment, Article Rule 100 of the rules relating to the pre-sentencing procedure, Article 23 of the statute relating to the penalties, and which provides in subparagraph 1 as follows. The trial chamber 1 will apply only a penalty relating to terms of imprisonment. The chamber in so doing shall have recourse to the general practice regarding prison sentences in the courts of Rwanda. Paragraph 2. In imposing the sentences, the trial chamber should take into account such factors as the gravity of the offense and the individual circumstances of the convicted person, and then the chamber considered Rule 101 of the rules, which also deals with the penalties and which provides in paragraph A thereof. A person convicted by the tribunal may be sentenced to imprisonment for a term up to and including the remainder of his life. Paragraph B. In determining the sentence, the trial chamber shall take into account the factors mentioned in Article 23.2 of the statute, as well as such circumstances as any aggravating circumstances, two, any mitigating circumstances, including the substantial cooperation with the prosecutor by the convicted person before or after conviction, three, the general practice regarding prison sentences in the courts of Rwanda, and lastly, four, the extent to which any penalty imposed by a court of any state on the convicted person for the same act has already been served, as referred to in Article 9.3 of the statute. Then the chamber also considered Article 26 of the statute, which deals with the enforcement of sentences, Rule 102 of the rules, which deals with the status of the convicted person, Rule 103 of the rules, which deals with the place of imprisonment, Article 27 of the statute, which deals with pardon or commutation of sentences, and lastly, Rule 104 of the rules, which deals with supervision of imprisonment. After having studied the applicable texts, the Chamber also considered the scale of penalties applicable to the convicted person, the crimes of which are mentioned in Articles 2, 3, or 4 of the Statute of the Tribunal, that is, the crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity, and Article 3 common to the Geneva Conventions, and additional Protocol 2 thereto. As noted from a reading of all the above mentioned provisions on penalties, the only penalties a tribunal can impose on an accused who pleads guilty or is convicted as such are prison terms up to and including life imprisonment, pursuant in particular to Rule 101A of the rules, whose provisions apply to all crimes which fall within the jurisdiction of the tribunal. The statute excludes any other form of penalty, for example, the death penalty, forced labor, or a fine. Both the statute in Article 23, as well as the rules in Rule 101, provide a specific penalty of the crimes falling within the jurisdiction of the tribunal. The determination of the penalty is left to the discretion of the chamber, which must take into consideration the general practice of prison sentences as applied in the courts of Rwanda, a number of other factors, including the gravity of the crime, the personal circumstances of the convicted person, the existence of any aggravating or mitigating circumstances, including the substantial cooperation by the convicted person before or after conviction. Whereas in most national systems, the scale of penalties is determined in accordance with the gravity of the offense, the chamber notes that, as indicated supra, the statute does not rank the various crimes falling under the jurisdiction of the tribunal, and thereby the sentence to be handed down. In theory, the sentences are the same for each of the three crimes, namely a maximum term of life imprisonment. The Chamber has no doubt that despite the gravity of the violations of Article 3 common to the Geneva Conventions, they are considered as lesser crimes than genocide or crimes against humanity. On the other hand, it seems more difficult for the Chamber to rank genocide and crimes against humanity in terms of their respective gravity. The Chamber holds that crimes against humanity, already punished by the Nuremberg and Tokyo tribunals, and genocide, a concept defined later, are crimes which particularly shock the collective conscience. The Chamber notes in this regard that the crimes prosecuted by the Nuremberg Tribunal, namely the Holocaust of the Jews or the Final Solution, were very much constitutive of genocide, but they could not be defined as such because the crime of genocide was not defined until later. Regarding the crime of genocide in particular, the preamble to the Genocide Convention of 1948 recognizes that the crime of genocide throughout history inflicted great losses on humanity and reiterates the need for international cooperation to liberate humanity from this scourge. The crime of genocide is unique because of its element of dolus specialis, special intent, which requires that the crime be committed with the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group as such, as stipulated in Article 2 of the statute. Hence, the Chamber is of the opinion that genocide constitutes the crime of crimes, which must be taken into account when deciding the sentence. However, considering their extreme gravity, crimes against humanity and genocide must receive appropriate sanctions or penalties. Rwanda, like all the states which have incorporated crimes against humanity or genocide in their domestic legislation, has envisaged the most severe penalties in the criminal legislation for these crimes. To this end, the Rwandan Organic Law on the Organization of Prosecutions for Offenses Constituting the Crime of Genocide or Crimes Against Humanity, committed since 1 October 1990, adopted in 1996, groups accused persons into four categories as follows. Thus, four categories have been created. In particular, category one thereof, which applies to persons whose criminal acts or those whose acts place them among planners, organizers, supervisors, and leaders of the crime of genocide or of a crime against humanity. B, a person or persons who acted in positions of authority at the national, prefectural, communal, sector or cell, or in a political party, the army, religious organizations, or militia, and who perpetrated or fostered such crimes. C. Notorious murderers who, by virtue of their zeal or excessive malice with which they committed atrocities, distinguished themselves in their areas of residence or where they passed. D. Persons who committed acts of sexual violence. As mentioned, as indicated supra, in determining the sentence, the chamber must, among other things, have recourse to the general practice regarding prison sentences in the courts of Rwanda, or as applied in the courts of Rwanda. The chamber notes that it is logical that in the determination of the sentence, it has recourse only to prison sentences applicable in Rwanda, to the exclusion of other sentences applicable in Rwanda, including the death sentence. That said, the chamber raises a question as to whether the scale of sentences applicable in Rwanda is mandatory or whether it is to be used only as a reference. The chamber is of the opinion that such reference is but one of the factors that it has to take into account in determining the sentences and depending on the case. Accordingly, like trial chamber one of the ICTY in the Ejdemovic case, which said, I quote, that the reference to this practice can be used for guidance, but is not binding. According to that chamber, this opinion is supported by the interpretation of the United Nations Secretary General, who, in his report on the establishment of the ICTY, stated that, quote, in determining the term of imprisonment, the trial chamber should have, want to underscore this, should have recourse to the general practice of prison sentences applicable in the courts of the former Yugoslavia. Regarding the penalties applicable in the courts of Rwanda, the chamber notes in this connection that since the events of 1994 began in this country, the death penalty and prison terms of up to life imprisonment have been passed on several occasions. However, the chamber does not have information on the contents of these decisions, particularly their underlying reasons. Consequently, while referring as much as practicable to the general practice regarding prison sentences in the courts of Rwanda, the chamber will prefer here too to lean more on its unfettered discretion each time that it has to pass a sentence on persons found guilty of crimes falling within its jurisdiction, taking into account the circumstances of the case and the standing of the accused persons. Then, in its decision, the chamber considered the general principles governing the determination of sentences. In determining the sentence, the chamber has to always have in mind that this tribunal was established by the Security Council pursuant to Chapter 7 of the Charter of the United Nations within the context of measures the Council was empowered to take under Article 39 of the said Charter to ensure that violations of international humanitarian law in Rwanda in 1994 were halted and effectively redressed. The objective in creating this tribunal was to prosecute and punish the authors or perpetrators of the atrocities in Rwanda in order to put an end to the culture of impunity and thereby to promote national reconciliation and the restoration of peace. It will be noted that the preamble of the Rwandan organic law referred to above states that, quote, considering that it is vital in order to achieve national reconciliation to forever eradicate the culture of impunity, considering that the exceptional situation facing the country requires the adoption of adequate measures to meet the need of the Rwandan people for justice, unquote. That said, it is clear that the penalties imposed on accused persons found guilty by the tribunal must be directed, on the one hand, at retribution of the said accused, who must see their crimes punished, and over and above that, on the other hand, at deterrence, namely dissuading for good those who will be attempted in future to perpetrate such atrocities by showing them that the international community was not ready or is not ready to tolerate the serious violations of international humanitarian law and human rights. The Chamber recalls, however, that in the determination of sentences, it is required by Article 23(2) of the Statute and Rule 101(b) of the Rules to take into account a number of factors, including the gravity of the offence, the individual circumstances of the accused, the existence of any aggravating or mitigating circumstances, including the substantial cooperation by the accused with the prosecutor before or after his conviction. It is a matter, as it were, of individualizing the penalty, for it is true that, quote, among the joint perpetrators of an offense or among the persons guilty of the same type of offense, there is only one common element, the target offense which they committed with its inherent gravity. Apart from this common trait, there are, of necessity, fundamental differences in their respective personalities and responsibilities, their age, their background, their education, their intelligence, their mental structure. It is not true that they are a priori subject to the same intensity of punishment. The judge, therefore, must be allowed to adapt the penalty prescribed by law to the individual responsibility or moral responsibility of each individual, unquote. So, while individualizing the penalty, the judges should not be limited to what is provided for strictly by the status. The determination or assessment of the facts should enable them to take into consideration any other factor that seems to them relevant. As concerns aggravating circumstances, it will be noted that the gravity of crimes such as genocide and crimes against humanity, which are particularly revolting to the collective conscience alone, is enough to merit lengthy elaboration. The Chamber will, however, come back to it when weighing the aggravating factors against the mitigating factor or factors in favor of the accused for the determination of the sentence. As far as the individual circumstances of the accused are concerned, the individualization of the sentence, as the expression itself seems to suggest, is not possible unless facts about his personality, are known, including his background, his behavior before, during, and after the offense, his motives for the offense, and demonstration of remorse thereafter. With regard to the mitigating circumstances, the statutes and the rules provide for two situations. First of all, Article 6, paragraph 4, states that the fact that an accused person acted pursuant to an order of a government or of a superior shall not relieve him of her criminal responsibility, but may be considered in mitigation of punishment if the tribunal determines that justice so requires. The problem should not arise in the instant case, since the accused was the Prime Minister. The second situation relating to mitigating circumstances is that provided for in the rules, which state in the Rule 101B, subparagraph 2, as mentioned above, with regard to attenuating or mitigating circumstances, the substantial cooperation by the convicted person with the prosecutor before or after the conviction. In this regard, when determining the sentence for Jean Kambanda, the chamber will have to assess the extent of the cooperation by the accused referred to by the prosecutor in the documents on the seal entitled, quote, agreement on a guilty plea, unquote, signed by the prosecutor, the accused, and his counsel. However, the wording of the above mentioned Rule 101, which talks of any mitigating circumstances, including the substantial cooperation, shows in the opinion of the chamber that substantial cooperation by the accused with the prosecutor could only be one mitigating circumstance among others when the accused pleads guilty or shows sincere repentance. Having said that, the chamber should nevertheless stress that the principle must always remain that the reduction of the penalties stemming from the application of mitigating circumstances must not in any way diminish the gravity of the offense. The aforementioned Rwandan organic law goes further because according to that law, persons falling under Category 1 cannot benefit from a reduction of sentence even after a guilty plea.
La chambre s'est ensuite penchée.
The chamber then considered the case on the merits. Having reviewed the principles set out above, the trial chamber proceeds to consider all relevant information submitted by both parties in order to determine an appropriate sentence in terms of Rule 100 of the rules. The chamber will do the facts of the case, first of all. Together with his guilty plea, Jean Kambanda submitted to the chamber a document entitled Plea Agreement between Jean Kambanda and the Office of the Prosecutor, signed on 28 April 1998 and signed by the accused and his counsel, Olivier Michael Inglis, and the prosecutor, and in which Jean Kambanda makes full admissions of all the relevant facts alleged in the indictment. And in particular, one, Jean Kambanda admits that there was in Rwanda in 1994 a widespread and systematic attack against the civilian population of Tutsi origin, the purpose of which was to exterminate them. Mass killings of hundreds of thousands of Tutsis occurred in Rwanda, including women and children, old and young, who were pursued and killed at places where they had sought refuge, in other words, prefectures, commune offices, schools, churches, and stadiums. Two, Jean Kambanda acknowledges that as Prime Minister of the interim government of Rwanda from 8 April to 17th July 1994, he was head of the 20-member Council of Ministers and exercised de jure authority and control over the members of his government. The government determined and controlled national policy and had the administration and armed forces at its disposal. As Prime Minister, he also exercised de jure and de facto authority over senior civil servants and senior officers in the military. Three, Jean Kambanda acknowledges that he participated in meetings of the Council of Ministers, cabinet meetings. He was involved in the decision of the government for visits to designated ministers to prefectures as part of the government's security efforts and in order to call on the civilian population to be vigilant in detecting the enemy and its accomplices. Jean Kambanda also acknowledges participating in the dismissal of the prefect of Butare because the latter had been opposed to the massacres and the appointment of a new prefect to ensure the spread of the massacres of the Tutsi in Butare. 4. Jean Kambanda acknowledges his participation in a high-level security meeting in Gitarama in April 1994 between the president, Sindiku Bwabo, himself, and the chief of staff of the Rwandan Armed Forces, FAR, and others, which discussed FAR's support in the fight against the Rwandan Patriotic Front, RPF, and its accomplices, understood to be the Tutsis and moderate Hutu. 5. Jean Kambanda acknowledges that he issued the directive on civil defense addressed to the prefect on 25th May 1994, directive number 0240273, disseminated on 8th June 1994. Jean Kambanda further admits that this directive encouraged and reinforced the Interahamwe who were committing massacres of the Tutsi civilian population in the prefecture. Jean Kambanda further acknowledges that by this directive, the government assumed the responsibility for the acts perpetrated by the Interahamwe. 6. Jean Kambanda acknowledges that before 6 April 1994, political parties, in concert with the Rwandan Armed Forces, organized and began the military training of youth wings of the MRND and CDR political parties, Interahamwe and Imhuzanga Mungambi, respectively, with the intent to use them in the massacres that ensued. Furthermore, Jean Kambanda acknowledges that the government headed by him distributed arms and ammunition to these groups. Additionally, Jean Kambanda confirms that roadblocks manned by mixed patrols of the Rwandan Armed Forces and the Interahamwe were set up in Kigali and elsewhere soon as the death of President Juvenal Habyarimana was announced on the radio. Furthermore, Jean Kambanda acknowledges that the use of the media as part of the plan to mobilize and incite the population to commit massacres of the civilian Tutsi population. That apart, Jean Kambanda recognizes the existence of groups within the military, militia, and political structures which had planned the elimination of the Tutsis and Hutu political opponents. 7. Jean Kambanda acknowledges that on or about 21 June 1994, in his capacity as Prime Minister, he gave clear support to Radio Télévision Libre des Mille Collines, RTLM, with the knowledge that it was a radio station whose broadcasts were incited killing, the commission of serious bodily or mental harm to, and persecution of Tutsi and moderate Hutu. On this occasion, speaking on this radio station, Jean Kambanda, as Prime Minister, encouraged the RTLM to continue to incite the massacres of the Tutsi civilian population, specifically stating that this radio station was, and I quote, an indispensable weapon in the fight against the enemy, end of quotation. 8. Jean Kambanda acknowledges that following numerous meetings of the Council of Ministers between 8th April 1994 and July 17, 1994, he, as Prime Minister, instigated, aided, and abetted the prefet, bourgmesters, and members of the population to commit massacres and killings of civilians, in particular Tutsi and moderate Hutu. Furthermore, Between 24 April and 17 July 1994, Jean Kambanda and ministers of his government visited several prefectures such as Butare, Gitarama, Gikongoro, Gisenyi, and Kibuye to incite and encourage the population to commit these massacres, including by congratulating the people who had committed these killings. 9. Jean Kambanda acknowledges that on the 3rd of May 1994, he was personally asked to take steps to protect children who had survived the massacre at a hospital, and he did not respond. On the same day, after the meeting, the children were killed. He acknowledges that he failed in his duty to ensure the safety of the children and the population of Rwanda. 10. Jean Kambanda admits that in his particular role of making public engagements in the name of the government, he addressed public meetings and the media at various places in Rwanda, directly and publicly inciting the population to commit acts of violence against Tutsi and moderate Hutu. He acknowledges uttering the incendiary phrase, which was subsequently repeated on broadcast, and I quote, "You refuse to give your blood to your country and dogs drink it for nothing," end of quote. 11. Jean Kambanda acknowledges that he ordered the setting up of roadblocks with the knowledge that these roadblocks were used to identify Tutsis for elimination, and that as Prime Minister he participated in the distribution of arms and munition to members of political parties, militias, and the population, knowing that these weapons would be used in the perpetration of massacres of civilian Tutsis. 12. Jean Kambanda acknowledges that he knew, or should have known, that persons for whom he was responsible were committing crimes of massacres upon Tutsi, and that he failed to prevent them or punish the perpetrators. Jean Kambanda admits that he was an eyewitness to the massacres of Tutsis and also had knowledge of them from regular reports of préfets and cabinet discussions. After having recalled the fact, which was necessary, as you recall, the document concerning the agreement between the prosecutor and Jean Kambanda was under seal, now it has been made public. The tribunal shall further move into the judgment. In light of the admissions made by Jean Kambanda, in amplification of his plea of guilty, the trial chamber on 1st May 1998 accepted his plea and found him guilty on the following counts. Jean Kambanda, by his acts or omissions described in paragraphs 312 to 315 and 317 to 319 of the indictment, is responsible for the killing of and the causing of serious bodily or mental harm to members of the Tutsi population with the intent to destroy, in whole or in part, an ethnic or racial group as such, and has thereby committed genocide, stipulated in Article 23A of the Statute of the Tribunal as a crime and attributed to him by virtue of Article 6.3 and punishable in reference to Articles 22 and 23 of the Statute. Jean Kambanda. 2. By his acts or omissions described in paragraphs 3.8, 3.9, 3.13 to 3.15 and 3.19 of the indictment, did conspire with others, including ministers of his government, such as Pauline Nyiramasuhuko, André Nhagerura, Eliezer Nyitigeka and Edouard Karamera, to kill and to cause serious bodily or mental harm to members of the Tutsi population with intent to destroy in whole or in part an ethnic or racial group as such, and has thereby committed conspiracy to commit genocide, stipulated in Articles 2, 3b of the statute as a crime and attributed to him by virtue of Article 6.1 and punishable in reference to Articles 22 and 23 of the statute of the tribunal. 3. By his acts or omission described in paragraphs 312 to 314 and 319 of the indictment, John Kambanda did directly and publicly incite to kill and to cause serious bodily or mental harm to members of the Tutsi population with intent to destroy in whole or in part an ethnic group as such, and has thereby committed direct and public incitement to commit genocide, stipulated in Article 2, 3c of the statute as a crime and attributed to him by virtue of Article 6.1 and 6.3, which is punishable in reference to Articles 22 and 23 of the statute of the tribunal. 4. By his acts or omissions described in paragraphs 310, 312 to 315 and 317 to 319 of the indictment, which did not constitute the same acts relied on for counts 1 and 2, Jean Kambanda was complicit in the killing and the causing of serious bodily or mental harm to members of the Tutsi population and thereby committed complicity in genocide stipulated in Article 2.3e of the statute as a crime and attributed to him by virtue of Article 6.1 and 6.3, which is punishable in reference to Articles 23 and 23 of the statute. 5. By his acts or omissions described in paragraphs 312 to 317 to 319 of the indictment, John Kambanda is responsible for the murder of civilians as part of a widespread or systematic attack against a civilian population on ethnic or racial grounds and has thereby committed a crime against humanity, stipulated in Article 3A of the statute as a crime and attributed to him by virtue of Article 6.1 and 6.3, which is punishable in reference to Articles 22 and 23 of the statute of the tribunal. Finally, and sixthly, by his acts or omissions described in paragraphs 312 to 315, and 317 to 319 of the indictment, Jean Kambanda is responsible for the extermination of civilians as part of a widespread or systematic attack against a civilian population on ethnic or racial grounds and has thereby committed a crime against humanity, stipulated in Article 3B of the statute as a crime and attributed to him by virtue of Article 6.1 and 6.3, which is punishable in reference to Articles 22 and 23 of the Statute of the Tribunal. Concerning the factors relating to the sentence, the Chamber recalls that in pronouncing sentence, it is taking into account, in conformity to the rules, matters such as the seriousness of the offense and the personal involvement of the accused, in other words, Jean Kambanda. Concerning the gravity of the crime, in the brief dated 10 August 1998, and in her closing argument at the hearing, the prosecutor stressed the gravity of the crimes of genocide and crimes against humanity, the heinous nature of the crime of genocide and its absolute prohibition makes its commission inherently aggravating. The magnitude of the crimes involving the killing of an estimated 500,000 civilians in Rwanda in a short span of 100 days constitutes an aggravating fact. Crimes against humanity are, as aforementioned, conceived as offenses of the gravest kind against the life and liberty of the human being. The crimes were committed during the time when Jean Kambanda was Prime Minister, and he and his government were responsible for maintenance of peace and security in Rwanda. Jean Kambanda abused his authority and the trust of the civilian population. He personally participated in the genocide by distributing arms, making incendiary speeches, and presiding over cabinet and other meetings where the massacres were planned and discussed. He failed to take necessary and reasonable measures to to prevent his subordinates from committing crimes against the population. Abuse of positions of authority or trust is considered an aggravating factor. Concerning the individual circumstances of Jean Kambanda, it is noted that Jean Kambanda was born on 10 October 1955 at Mubumbano in the prefecture of Butare. He has a wife and two children. He holds a diploma of Ingénieur Commercial, and from May 1989 to April 1994, he worked in the Union des Banques Populaires du Rwanda, rising to the position of director of the network of those banks. He was vice president of the Butare section of the MDR and member of its political bureau. On 9 April 1994, he became prime minister of the interim government. The prosecutor has not proved previous criminal convictions, if any, of Jean Kambanda. Now we move on to the mitigating factors. Defense counsel has proffered three factors in mitigation: plea of guilty, remorse, which he claims is evident from the act of pleading guilty, and cooperation provided by the accused to the office of the prosecutor. The prosecutor confirms that Jean Kambanda has extended substantial cooperation and invaluable information to the prosecutor. The prosecutor requests the trial chamber to regard as a significant mitigating factor not only the substantial cooperation so far extended, but also the future cooperation when Jean Kambanda testifies for the prosecution in the trials of other accused. The plea agreement signed by the parties expressly records that no agreements, understandings, or promises have been made between the parties with respect to the sentence. It is acknowledged is at the discretion of the trial chamber. The prosecutor, however, disclosed that Jean Kambanda's cooperation has been recognized by significant protection measures that have been put in place to alleviate any concerns that he may have about the security of his family. According to the prosecutor, Jean Kambanda had expressed his intention to plead guilty immediately upon his arrest and transfer to Arusha on the 18th of July, 1997. The accused declared in the above-mentioned agreement that he had resolved to plead guilty even before his arrest in Kenya, and that his prime motivation for pleading guilty was the profound desire to tell the truth, as the truth was the only way to restoring national unity and reconciliation in Rwanda. Jean Kambanda condemned the massacres that occurred in Rwanda and considered his confession as a contribution towards the restoration of peace in Rwanda. The chamber notes, however, that Jean Kambanda did not offer any explanation for his voluntary participation in the genocide, nor has he expressed contrition, regret, or sympathy for victims in Rwanda, even when given the opportunity to do so yesterday by the chamber during the hearing of 3rd September 1998. The representative of the prosecution and the defense have urged the chamber to interpret John Kambanda's guilty plea as a signal of his remorse, repentance, and acceptance of responsibility for his actions. The chamber is mindful that remorse is not the only reasonable inference that can be drawn from a guilty plea. Nonetheless, it accepts that most national jurisdictions consider admissions of guilt as matters properly to be considered in mitigation of punishment. In civil criminal law systems, a guilty plea may be favorably considered as a mitigating factor, subject to the discretionary faculty of a judge. The chamber has furthermore been requested to take into account in favor of Jean Kambanda that his guilty plea has also occasioned judicial economy, saved victims the trauma and emotions of trial, and enhanced the administration of justice. The prosecutor asked that a life sentence be imposed upon Jean Kambanda, but requested the trial chamber in the determination of sentence to take into account the plea of guilty and the cooperation provided to her office. Counsel for the defense underscored the fact that Jean Kambanda was a tool in the hands of the military and that he had no say. Consequently, he invited the tribunal, taking into account the guilty plea made by Jean Kambanda, of the cooperation that he provided and will continue to provide to the prosecutor, and the role that Jean Kambanda may play in the role of reconciliation in Rwanda, to provide a 2-year maximum sentence. The chamber finds that the gravity of the crime has been established and the mitigatory impact on the penalty has been characterized. The chamber holds the view that a finding of mitigating circumstances relating to assessment of sentence and in no way derogates from the gravity of the crime. It mitigates punishment, not the crime. The degree of magnitude of the crime is still an essential criterion for evaluation of sentence. A sentence must reflect the predominant standard and of proportionality between the gravity of the offense and the degree of responsibility of the offender. Just sentences contribute to respect of law and the maintenance of a just, peaceful, and safe society. The trial chamber has examined all the submissions presented by the two parties pertaining to the determination of sentence, for which it can be inferred that Jean Kambanda has cooperated and still willingly cooperating with the Office of the Prosecutor. The guilty plea of Jean Kambanda is likely to encourage other individuals to recognize their responsibility during the tragic events which occurred in Rwanda in 1994. A guilty plea is generally considered in most national jurisdictions, including Rwanda, as a mitigating circumstance. And finally, the said guilty plea coming from the former Prime Minister is particularly important for the process of national reconciliation in Rwanda. But, however, firstly, the crimes for which Jean Kambanda is responsible carry an intrinsic gravity, and their widespread, atrocious, and systematic character is particularly shocking to the human conscience. Secondly, Jean Kambanda committed these crimes knowingly and with premeditation. Thirdly, and mostly, the crimes are unacceptable because, as Prime Minister, Jean Kambanda had the duty and authority to protect the population of Rwanda and to maintain order and security. He failed in his responsibility. On the basis of the foregoing, the chamber is of the view that the aggravating circumstances surrounding the crimes committed by Jean Kambanda negate widely the mitigating circumstances, and especially since Jean Kambanda occupied a high ministerial post at the time he committed the said crimes. This therefore negates any mitigating circumstances. I now call upon Jean Kambanda to stand up in order to hear the verdict. The verdict. Trial Chamber 1. For the foregoing reasons, delivering its decision in public pursuant to Articles 23, 26, and 27 of the Statute and Rules 100, 101, 102, 103, and 104 of the Rules of Procedure and Evidence, noting the general practice of sentencing by the courts of Rwanda, noting the indictment as confirmed on 16 October 1997, noting the plea of guilty of Jean Kambanda on 1 May 1998 of the counts of count 1, genocide, count 2, conspiracy to commit genocide, count 3, direct and public incitement to commit genocide, count 4, complicity in genocide, count 5, crime against humanity, murder, count 6, crime against humanity, extermination. The chamber has found Jean Kambanda, given the statements made by the prosecutor and the defense counsel, for the above-mentioned crimes, for John Kambanda, born on 10 October 1955 in the commune of Gishambuvu, prefecture of Butare in Rwanda, to life imprisonment, decides that the imprisonment shall be in a state decided upon tribunal with the registrar and the trial chamber, and that the registrar shall designate the state for the imprisonment. Rules that this judgment shall be enforced immediately, and that until his transfer to the said place of imprisonment, Jean Kambanda shall be kept in detention under the present conditions. Arusha, 4 September 1998, signed by Lady Kama, presiding judge, Lennart Aspergren from Sweden, judge, Navanathan Pillay from South Africa, judge. The seal of the tribunal has been opposed to the document. It is so decided. I am asking Jean Kambanda to withdraw.
The hearing stands adjourned.